comment cards if you want to make comments. You'll need to fill one of those out if you need to make a public comment on the item on the agenda. So refer to it. One thing was the rack packets came out by email this month. And so you had to print that from your email. They're electronic, or you can download them from the website. So, anyway. Yeah, if you got a Dropbox account.
Or you can call here and we'll get it to you.
And then you can get it printed.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to update the board members and keep them posted. So I guess we ought to approve the agenda and also the minutes. Did everybody get a chance to look at the agenda and review the minutes from last board meeting in May? So
I'll make a motion that we approve the minutes from last month and the agenda for this month.
I'll second it.
Okay. Thank you. Guess I ought to give a quick update on what happened. Oh, all in favor? May's meeting went out to that wildlife board meeting, and our RAC had passed all the motions unanimously on the turkey management plan, the turkey transplant proposed, the upland game and turkey and crane recommendations, and the game bird rule amendment and the waterfowl recommendation and the Utah trial hunter program. So it was a good board meeting. Nothing of spectacular interest that I recall with the animal, but that's been a long ago. So, go ahead.
One point of interest, the crow. The crow issue, it took a lot of, as you recall, probably,
yeah,
there was a lot of comment, a lot of back and forth, and it passed, and then these rules have an opportunity to be reviewed again. Once they've passed, then they move on up to the legislature and up there, and they'll take a look at it, and if they get a lot of comments, they make us go back at the Wildlife Board and readdress it. And this week, on Tuesday, they had to readdress the crow issue, and but they didn't get any comment that was any different from the original meeting, and so it went through again, and it also passed again with a vote of 3-2, and so there'll still be the crow hunt. Now, folks, keep that in mind, that it's crow hunt, not raven, and there is a difference, and so you need to. It's unlikely that you're going to see a crow out here in the basin, but they mostly down along the Wasatch Front and through the orchards and things like that. So, but it passed again, and it'll carry this time. I just thought I'd pass that information on.
That's good, Boyd. Also, there was a lot of interest from environmental groups that were there. There was a lot of comments made. I think the awareness was raised with those that weren't familiar with the crows and ravens and different things. One thing that was interesting was the northern RAC opposed the ruling, and that's the one that it affects the most, but yet the Wildlife Board reviewed it, talked about it, and they passed it. So. Okay, welcome, Carrie.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
A little squeaky, sorry. I apologize for being late.
Must have been the RSL game, right?
No, I was fishing in Tabby, and I was really ripping into him, and I lost track of time.
Okay. Well, let's turn some time over to Boyd and have a regional update.
Great. I'll start it off with our game management section. We're in the process of our preseason counts for elk and pronghorn, most in particular pronghorn. We don't have any of the data together yet. We're also taking care of our rabbit routes. They're way up from what they were have been the last few years. Some of you may have noticed that there's quite a few more rabbits around. And we've got bears and bears and some more bears. And we've got bear issues down in Little Hole right now. We've got a couple out in Book Cliffs. The ones out in the Book Cliffs have gotten into a couple trailers and tore them up pretty good. And then, Dax, you said there was another one that got into a trailer?
Calder.
Up at Calder, up on Diamond. So there's a bear there. We've removed a couple of bears. We've had one at Greendale Junction. And then we had one, a female, with a couple of cubs that was hit on the road. And she didn't make it, but we were able to capture the cubs. And they went off to a rehab center that we have down in Millville. And they'll be kept there until we can get them out and get them into their right habitat here, probably after the winter. So they'll be carried over and be fed and looked after. And I've seen them; they're pretty round by the time they get out in the spring, because they go through several bags of dog food before they're out there. So. But we have had, and I expect it to get worse before it gets better. With this dry season that we've had, most of the grasses that have come up, the natural food is dried off, come up and dies and dries out. And then this rain may cause some more green up, which is what we'd like to see. This could be a pretty bad year for bears. We've had two really good years without any problems previous to this, so we kind of expected it or maybe deserved it or something. I don't know what you'd want to call it, but we've got a lot of bear issues going right now, as well as our depredation complaints are up a little bit right now because of the dry conditions. It's forcing some of our animals, such as pronghorn, where the only green feed is out in some of these fields that are irrigating. And so they've got some issues that pronghorn are trying to stay alive, and landowners are trying to make a living, and we're trying to get as much water where we can. So it's been a problem. Our habitat work, all of our spring work that we started has been completed. Our fall work is now getting in the developmental stages, and our guys are getting ready to collect bids and go out and be putting in some guzzlers. We've got some guzzlers that will be going in here this next week. Our impact analysis guys have been really busy all spring and into the summer now with all the new pipelines and roads and power lines. And now we're also assessing a rail line that they're looking at to rail this heavy crude out of the basin. And so we'll be looking at that and trying to mitigate for where it goes and what habitats it's going to go through and things like that. So just a whole myriad, a lot of things with dealing with the oil and gas and wildlife and the effects. And our guys are right on top of them, watching where they go, and what we need to do and where we can direct them the best ways that we can to preserve our wildlife, but yet still keep the economy going here in the basin. Our law enforcement, we've had some comings and goings, some changes. You might notice a stranger in the back, Tori's come back to us. He decided he didn't like it in the city, and we're glad to have him back out here. He's back as our lieutenant, and Dan moved back to his sergeant position, and Sean moved back to his original position, and we have a new CO that's going to be moving out to Manila, and he'll start today, or?
August 9th,
and his name is?
Shane Kitchen.
And one of the best things about Shane is he really, really, really wanted to be there. And so when we get guys that want to be there and are looking forward to being there, that's pretty exciting for us because we know that they're going to stay there for a long time, enjoy the people they work with and the communities they work around.
Well, Shane was from the area too. He grew up in Tridale, so he's got family contacts.
Did you say Shane Kitchen? Oh, yeah, okay. That's probably relation to Boyd, maybe, or...
Yeah,
okay.
That's
all right, good.
And then we are on track to get a new Roosevelt officer, but he won't be out here until about the first of the year.
Yeah.
January.
about December or so, January. So, and that'll be good, and if we can get those in place, we'll have a full contingent, finally. It's been a few years. So we're pretty excited about that, and they're just chomping at the bit, ready to work. For our aquatic section, our stocking has been really good. We've included some wipers and browns, rainbows, some tiger muskie getting put in. Our Brownie Reservoir there is down. You'll notice it's way down. We had to bring it down to below the pipe, the outlet, so that we could check the pipes and see what was wrong. They've gone in there and found that we're going to have to replace the pipes on Brownie. So I'm not exactly sure how long that's going to be down. We've increased the catch limit on Brownie from 4 to 8. And we've heard that people are catching pretty good fish there. On our outreach section, we finished an osprey watch up at the gorge, and it went very well. A lot of people came out and enjoyed seeing the osprey. The division purchased a clay pigeon flinger, and Keith's done a really good job flinging those pigeons, right? No, okay. We purchased a clay pigeon flinger out there, and we've been working with the young people. We had an impromptu training, and so we invited a youth group out to shoot some clay pigeons with it. They had a good time, and they were able to be trained, and so we're looking forward to that. We have a new position that's coming up in the region called our wildlife recreation, outdoor recreation position. There was 4 positions statewide. There was 58 people to put in for that position. So right now we're currently going through all the different folks and we'll be holding interviews real soon on that. So we should have that position filled by our next RAC meeting. And with that, unless there's any questions, I'll turn the time back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's drop back on the agenda just a little bit. Let's do introductions. Everybody's here. You just want to introduce yourself, who you represent, and your name, be great.
My name's Tim McNashville. I represent the Ute Indian Tribe.
And Rod Morrison, I represent Sportsman.
Mitch Hacking, I represent Wildlife.
I'm Carrie Messerly, I'm Vice Chair, and I represent Public at Large.
Wayne McAllister, Public at Large and Chair.
And I'm Boyd Blackwell. I'm the Regional Supervisor and the Secretary of this group.
I'm David Gordon, representing BLM.
Randy Durth, representing Sportsman.
Andrea Merrill, representing Non-Consumptive.
Dan, a beta of the Forest Service.
All right, thank you.
Let me add to this on this bear thing out in the book close. We worked with the BLM on that, and there's been a overnight camping restriction placed on the PR Springs and Willow Canyon area for 2 weeks. We've got 2 traps, and we're going to take a 3rd out there. We're also going to look at using houndsmen to do what we can to help us with these problem bears. So folks may be contacted to help us to do that. But we appreciate the efforts working with the BLM. We made a recommendation to close that for a couple weeks till we could deal with this problem bear. And they stepped up, and I think that's all.
Okay, good. Well, let's just kind of review the way the meeting will go forward. We'll have a presentation. The RAC will have an opportunity to ask questions. The public will have an opportunity to ask questions. And after that, you need to fill out a comment card. The public can make comment. So we'll have RAC comments and then public comments. So there'll be a time limit on the comments, 3 minutes, and things that way as we proceed forward at this time. So we're going to go into number five, the turkey depredation unit. We want to hear from Jason Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator based out of Salt Lake City. Here to talk tonight about Rule 657-69, Turkey Depredation. What I'd like to do to start off is give a little bit of background information on wild turkeys, just to kind of get the rack up to speed. Turkeys were extirpated from many areas in the U.S., and they hit their lowest numbers in the 1930s. There was actually some concern of extinction of turkeys at that time. One of the interesting things is evidence shows that wild turkeys are native to Utah. There's pictographs, petroglyphs, and archaeological evidence. So I showed a few photos there of some petroglyphs from what look like turkey prints. Reintroductions of turkeys started in Utah as early as the 1920s, when turkey numbers were their lowest throughout the country. Aggressive and more successful efforts began in 1989. So turkey populations are doing very well now, both within the entire United States and as well as Utah. And one of the things we want to emphasize is restoration of wild turkeys is a real wildlife success story, and we want to continue to promote that message. However, when you have a species that is expanding as fast as turkeys are, they can create some human-turkey conflicts. You may remember I presented the Wild Turkey Management Plan at the last RAC. That plan was approved by the board here in June. Goal B within that management plan states that want to minimize human wild turkey conflicts and more specifically decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints by 25%. Going back a year and a half ago, there was a bill at the legislature, Bill 342, Wild Turkey Management, which was passed. Essentially created Utah Code or Law 23-17-5.1. So it requires the DWR to investigate and mitigate material damage to private property by wild turkeys. The division will respond within 72 hours. We have a variety of options available to us, including hazing, transplants, and additional hunts. That law also gives rulemaking authority to the Wildlife Board to administer provisions related to that bill. So essentially what we have is a law that's already passed. And what we're trying to do is, with this rule, is create the sideboards to allow us to implement that law that's in place. And so the proposed rule I have tonight for you, 657-69, is to implement that law that's already in place. So going into the rule specifically, if a turkey causes material damage to private property, the property owner will report it to DWR. Material damage is defined as physical impacts to private property caused by turkeys that are visible, persistent, and detrimental to the landowner or lessee's use of the private property. The DWR, once they receive that report, will respond within 72 hours. The DWR may remove the turkeys right when we arrive, if that seems the best option, or implement a damage mitigation and prevention plan with landowner approval and ultimately signature of both the division and the landowner. So within the damage mitigation and prevention plan, the division may provide educational material to the landowner to increase tolerance of turkeys, haze the turkeys off the property, exclude the turkeys through fences, tarps, or other means, capture and relocate the turkeys, allow harvest, through our limited entry or general season permits, sign the property up for walk-in access or CWMU, issue a depredation hunt, offer the landowner control permits, or offer the landowner control permit vouchers, and I'll go into detail of each of these. So capture and relocate. Utah has a very successful history of capturing and relocating turkeys. The reality is, for this region, you'll probably be on the benefiting end, I think. You'll end up receiving a lot of these turkeys from other regions because there's a lot of turkey habitat here in the northeast region that we can move turkeys to. So again, we can move these birds to RAC and board approved sites. So again, you may remember from last RAC meeting, a transplant list was approved with 231 sites statewide. So we still have a lot of areas to move turkeys. Again, capture and relocate is an effective tool. We're still trying to grow turkeys in the state, but it doesn't work in all situations. So we've got to have additional options available for us for dealing with these turkeys. So depredation hunts. Depredation hunts are a focused response to verified reports of material damage. These hunts are small areas with short notice and a limited number of permits. The hunter would apply online through the hunter depredation pool. They'd be selected randomly when these hunts occur. That hunter must have a valid hunting or combination license. They must also purchase a permit to be eligible. The regional supervisor for each of the regions, Boyd for this region, would approve the boundaries, season dates, bag limits, sex, weapons, etc. Control permits for turkeys, they may be part of that damage mitigation and prevention plan. There's a maximum of 2 control permits per calendar year. The permits would be issued for the landowner or lessee or an immediate family member or employee of the landowner. These permits are free to the landowner, and each permit is valid for 1 either sex turkey on the private property. The next option we would make available would be control permit vouchers. Again, these may be part of the damage mitigation and prevention plan. DWR may issue vouchers for up to 10% of the documented turkeys on the private property with a maximum of 15 vouchers per calendar year. These would be for the landowner, lessee, or designate a third-party recipient. So the landowner could then choose basically a non-family member or someone else that could get that control permit voucher and exchange it for a permit. A landowner may not gain financial compensation for the voucher's use. A voucher allows the holder to purchase a control permit. Again, they must have a valid hunting or combination license to redeem the voucher. Each control permit is valid for 1 either sex turkey on the private property. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions by the RAC?
Yeah, I've got a question. So no monetary compensation then for these private landowners? I mean, if there's property damage occurring, they get vouchers or they get other things, but no, is that different than, say, big game
it is.
Damage?
Yes.
Depredation?
Yeah, so what we want to do
is... not an issue or what?
Usually turkeys cause very little damage if they do. And what we really want to do is take care of the problem. And what we can do is, in most cases, we want to capture and move those turkeys from areas where they're causing damage to areas where we know we want turkeys,
sure.
231 sites statewide. So that's going to be our primary option. And that's what we want to do is help the landowner solve the issue, not just put a Band-Aid on it.
Where are you having your most problems?
Most of them are kind of the I-15 corridor, to be honest, where most of the people are. The northern region, we've had some issues up there. Central region's had some, and southern region. The eastern half of the state, not as much. So usually where we have a lot of people and turkeys is where we're getting most of the complaints.
Thank you.
That's what I said. I've never heard anybody complaining in any areas I've been in.
That's good.
In fact, it's kind of a novelty to see them, you know, really.
That's part of the problem, isn't it? That people are feeding them at their homestead, and then at some point the population starts to grow, and before too long you don't have a garden.
Exactly. Think,
or a dog.
Seems to be kind of a threshold. You know, 15, 20 of them are pretty cool. 100 of them, not as much.
So much. It's a disaster. It really is a disaster.
Do you have a problem with domesticating themselves by coming into a farmer's, you know, where he's feeding other livestock during the winter?
You know, they become less wary, and so some of these hunting options, that's why we want to have a variety of options, just to allow, you know, not one tool is going to work in every situation. So hopefully some of these fall hunts that you heard about last RAC meeting, we'll put a little bit more wild back in our wild turkeys, especially in that fall winter time.
Any other questions by the RAC? Any questions by the public? Okay, we'll go into comments. Comments by the RAC. Okay. We have no comment cards for the public on item 5. So, thank you.
You'll have
we need
to have
a motion. We have an action on this, so. Anyway, so I'm looking to the board. I need a motion and a second.
I'll make the motion to accept the BWR's proposal as presented.
Okay.
I'll second it.
Anybody seconds it? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was waiting for you on this one.
Yeah.
It was your turn to go first.
Kenny Johnson. And we're on number 6, proposed fee schedule for fiscal year 2015.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bear with me for just 1 minute. I updated this presentation slightly.
While he's doing that, Boyd, I got a question. How much trouble can a guy get in if he's got a dog run about the size of half this room? He's got a couple bird dogs in it, and he comes home and there's turkey feathers everywhere.
I'd say state prison.
Well, I guess you want to know who's the who owns the dog, and then
no one owns the dog.
Then have a chat with him.
I'm not going anywhere.
You're not getting me. That's an unfortunate incident.
Yeah, there's no way it could have taken off once it got inside that 6-foot chain link fence. Yeah. Dogs have a smile on their face.
Yeah. Isn't that called survival?
Is that experience dogging?
Yeah. I just heard about it.
Safe.
A friend.
Did you help him take care of the problem?
I have to pick up the feathers.
On this thumb drive, I'm trying to get it to open. Sorry.
Is that not E? E?
Yes.
No.
No.
just going to have to wing it.
Oh, yeah, this one is Oh, no, it was on the app that says we're in the
I promised to meet your name. I think I'm Tori's been gone too long.
You ever been road fishing then?
Road fishing?
Yeah, okay. So there's road hunting, which I have an apathy against. I think that's cheating, but road fishing is awesome with a fly rod. Absolutely. I Jimmy rigged up this really cool magnetic thing that holds my fly pole in the back of the truck. So I can just pop it in the side and it sits in there and I can cruise down the road and rip it. That's
nice.
That makes you quick getaways, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Why, yes. I don't know what you're talking about. You were the one driving the getaway car, so.
Quick getaways.
That's why he was trying to wait for me.
I won't tell you states ever.
It would be no fun if I was in jail.
That's he wouldn't last in jail.
No.
Oh man.
Or it just new plan.
Yes,
right. Oh, my God.
Well, that's
good.
Well,
that's
good.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, cataract problems.
I found out for the last 6 months that there's such a thing as a cat. A domestic house cat.
Is that it, Kenny?
A bob cat called Pixie Bob.
Yeah. From what I understand, I don't know.
That's my hair. She was telling me that her mom has one.
So I went back
and looked up, and sure enough, yeah, you can see websites and it's kind of some of them. A lot of them are with them across from the cat.
All right, I think we're there. Sorry.
They'll have the.
You'll thank me for that later. I tried to clarify some of the points we'll discuss tonight with what we've learned in the last couple of racks. So we've got a little bit more information, a little bit more clarity, and it's probably worth noting that some of this overlaps with the presentation you're going to get here in 20 minutes, hopefully. And so there's a couple of proposals that impact our revenue and what we're going to propose revenue-wise. So let's just jump right into it. So fees, I think most of us here are familiar somewhat with how the process works. It takes a long time. When we want to implement a new fee, it takes us about a year and a half or 2 years to be able to implement it because of the paperwork and the process involved. And so it starts at this level. We bring it through our public process through the RACs. We take that product and then go to the Wildlife Board for their input and approval. After the Wildlife Board, it goes to the governor's office. We work with them on a recommendation to the legislature. And then we work with our Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee to approve, modify, or reject that proposal. And then any fees that committee approves are included in the annual appropriations bill, or the big bill, and all the legislators vote on that. And then that becomes part of the next fiscal year's fees. And so for these, this would all take place in the upcoming session in January, February, and then the fees would kick in July 1st of 2015. Real quick, division funding overview. This doesn't change a lot. And this is just kind of how our finances work. So that big, start with the biggest slice of pie there, that 48% is our restricted revenue. And that's licenses from probably everybody in this room, people that hunt, fish, and trap, and support wildlife through their participation. And that's primarily how we fund our programs and projects. That next biggest slice, that 29%, is federal funds. So we do get some match based on licensed purchasers. We get some federal funds to help out. That 12% is our dedicated credits. So that's a lot of partnerships with conservation partners and those kinds of monies used for projects. And then a little tiny bit of general fund, that 9%. And so that's the little piece that comes in for more general things that the legislature may be concerned with. So that's just kind of how we're funded. So a large portion of that just rests on the shoulders of sportsmen and women in and out of our state. And so some of the impacts of that, being self-funded primarily, we always try to balance our fees with what we're doing in the field and the projects we're doing to protect fish and wildlife. And so what we're going to talk about tonight, really four things. A couple new opportunities for the public, and then a couple of modifications to fees and one program. So specifically, we're going to talk about a fee change for bobcat, muskrat, a fee change, and a future rule change, and then a new concept, which is that two-cal elk permit, and then U permits for Rocky and Desert Bighorns. And so just kind of a reminder, this presentation establishes essentially on our fee schedule the fees that we can then use at some future date. So I don't have a ton of detail on how these things are going to work, what they're going to look like. What will happen is we'll have a placeholder in the fee schedule after this, we hope, and then at some future date we'll bring more information, more detail about how that will be implemented out to the racks for you guys to weigh in on and have input on. So tonight really just kind of establishes those fees for us to use in the future. Revenue projections. The proposed fees tonight we expect will generate between $60,000 and about $107,000-$110,000. So nothing like what we brought you last summer with combination of fishing increases. And it really just kind of depends on the implementation of what you'll be presented later with the bobcat rule. So I wanted to clarify that a little bit. And I'll show you a little more specific information here on bobcat in just a second. So, and then again, the new revenue just contributes that needed funding to kind of help manage all of the various programs. So bobcat specifically, our costs, kind of like all businesses, continue to increase. Some of the specific costs associated with managing bobcats or the rabbit transects, the tooth aging, the harvest reporting, the jaw pellet and sealing process, the admin to kind of oversee it and set up those sales in the computer. The increased revenue from what we're proposing tonight will just help to manage the species. We just wanted to note that, you know, pellet prices, the last report I saw showed an average of 407, and I know that's different parts of the state, but, you know, it's just an average. It's a middle ground cost that was reported back to us. The program on average runs $191,000 annually to just manage and maintain the service that's out there now. So more specifically, when we look at bobcat in the fur bearer program in general, let's just take a second on this slide, and I think it'll clarify some of the discussions we've had to this point and some of the other acts. When you look at the line by line display here, current bobcat revenue, it's a $5 license. It's been like that since 85. It's been a long time. We sold last year, this is based on last year's actual sales, so the quantity was 4,400-ish resident. We had the little strange happening on bobcat morning that you guys might have gotten into with the fees acting weird. And so we actually ended up approving a few more than that, but this is what we have on the books as an estimate. So 4,400 resident at $22,000 annually in revenue. A couple hundred non-residents at $5 a piece for them as well, which was $1,000. The fur bearer license, we want to make sure everybody gets credit. You have to have a fur bearer license to participate as a bobcat trapper as well, and that brings in $69,000. For residents and just under $10,000 for non-residents. And so total, you can see that the contributions add up to that $101,000 roughly. The average for the last couple of years to run the program on the field, this is a really conservative average. It's what we could find in Salt Lake in a little bit of time I had too this morning. So this is really conservative. It probably doesn't pick up all the charges that would hit codes that are specific to fur bearers and bobcats, but that's around $191,000 a year, the average, when you calculate all the time and effort that goes into that. So you can see the annual shortfall in the program is roughly that, $90,000. So what we're proposing, this is, again, just a breakdown of what we're trying to do. The current fee's $5. We're proposing that go to $15 for residents and to $45 for non-residents. And based on last year's actual sales, that would bring us roughly $52,000. You're going to hear a proposal in a minute to maybe increase the quota and increase the number that an individual can buy in. So I put some numbers to that as an estimate as well. Our peak year at $5, and Bill and Leslie maybe help me a little bit, but our peak year when we did Bobcat, similar to what you see on the asterisk side there, no quota and six per individual, we sold about 11, it was just over 11,000 permits at $5 a piece, and that was somewhere in 2006 or 7, if I remember right. And so what we did is we took an estimate. I don't know that I could say we'll do 11,000 again at $15. At $5 we might have. And so what I did is I just reduced that proportionally, took about a 20% estimate off to get that quantity of 9,000. And we think if we increase it to $15, the new revenue would land somewhere around $91,000. For residents and about $8,000 for non-residents. So total with this proposal, 15 again for residents, 45 for non-resident, we think will bring in just about $100,000 and help cover the costs of managing the program. So that is it for Bobcat Muskrat. This one's an interesting one too. It's not a recreational trapping opportunity. On our waterfowl management areas, we have a real need to protect our dikes and levees. And so, you know, currently, and you'll see it on the next slide, a little bit more detail. Currently we have about 12 permits that we issue. And right now it's just a random draw and the public pays a little bit of money. And sometimes we get great trappers that come in and do that work. And sometimes maybe not as skilled or as diligent. And so what we want to do is just make sure that we're meeting the needs out there on those waterfowl management areas. And so what we're proposing tonight for you guys to consider is that we just drop this variable fee from the fee schedule right now. It's that second bullet down. A successful applicant for those 12 permits pays somewhere between $30 and $155 to go trap on our waterfowl management areas. And we generate a whole $560 from that right now. So it isn't bringing in, you know, tons of money, and sometimes it's hit and miss as far as how effective it is. And so what we want to do is drop these from the fee schedule and at some future point bring a rule out that would allow us to put the muskrat process out for bid. So just to contract with people we know that can do the work and deliver on some of our expectations. So we think revenue will increase a little bit. We estimated that we might jump to a couple hundred dollars each for those, and so revenue for that would go to somewhere around $2,400. And again, that's just an estimate. Until it's out there and up and running, we won't know exactly, but that's an estimated revenue. Another new, so this is a new opportunity. This is the two cow permit. Again, a placeholder, a fee that we may be able to use for specific purposes in the future to meet our management objectives. And again, I'm not the expert. We've got a few here that if we have some more questions, we can probably get into it a little deeper. But what we want to do essentially is allow one person to have a permit that has two cow opportunity on it. So right now that fee doesn't exist. And that's why it's blank. And we're proposing for residents that we sell a two cow permit for $80 and a non-resident two cow permit for $350, and you can see the corresponding quantities there. We estimated those a little bit conservative because it could offset some of the current permits that are out there, and this was our best way to guess at what the revenue might do. It could actually cost us money, dependent on how it's implemented, but we think it'll be pretty close to revenue neutral, and maybe in certain spots bring us a little tiny bit of revenue. So that's a new opportunity, a new fee. The next one was the desert and Rocky Mountain bighorn ewe hunting opportunity. We'd like to create this for sportsmen statewide and be able to fold that into a future management plan. Right now, removing the problem animals ourselves is kind of the first and really the go-to way to control problem animals that move into areas where we maybe don't want them or they shouldn't be. And we just want to share that opportunity with the public. We don't have a fee to do that now. And so we think this just allows us to fold that in as a management tool in the future. And what we're proposing specifically there for residents, $100. We estimate maybe 10 of those, $1,000 in revenue. Non-residents would be charged a little bit more for that opportunity if we allowed it for them. Maybe one of those at $300. So again, not lots of new revenue there, but more importantly, a shared opportunity that's new and maybe unique to the public and gets us a little bit of help with some of that as well. So in summary, the new fees and minor adjustments, we think just help us meet the mission objectives a little bit better, creates a little bit new public opportunity, and brings in some of that revenue to help consistently deliver the services that we're providing now. And that is all I have.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions by the rack? McKinney.
Yeah, how much is a muskrat pelt worth? You mentioned a bobcat was worth like $420 or something like that. What's a muskrat pelt worth?
They vary. I've heard a lot of different things from a couple of bucks to under 10 usually. Does anyone else know?
The highest we've seen is 13.
Got a question? A lot of these fees are simply placeholders, so we can't implement them in the future, correct, given that there's tax. Is there currently, for the mentor program, a placeholder on the fee schedule for that?
Mentors, it's not new fees. It's okay. Essentially using permits that already exist.
Okay, and so it's we just think in we're, addition to yeah. that. I just wondered if that was necessary.
Yeah, we've covered the new statute just kind of provides that you can share and you know, permits in certain situations.
Are there certain areas where these where we're having problems with sheep, ewe sheep? Are there certain areas, or is this sort of a general proposal right now?
That's a great question. Bill's probably our expert. I know he had my back a lot last night. So
we've had several problems this last year. We took 11 down on the south book cliffs near Nashwash. What we've had is a group of sheep that moved into an area with domestic sheep, and we don't want to have the risk of
sure.
disease transmission. We had another group over by Bicknell over at what we call the Sun Globe Herd, and we had out on the Grassy Mountains where we removed one ram, and then we've had a couple of others. We did a little bit of work a few years ago at a Goslin Mountain as well, and we could possibly use those permits in a case like that. But it also gives us a tool in the future if we ever are lucky enough to have so many bighorn sheep that we need to do it for population control, you know, that would be a great problem to have. So, and I would mention, we're not going to propose that be a once-in-a-lifetime permit. We would recommend to the RAC and to the board to be like have a five-year waiting period.
Question, has the drought caused any problems for you? Like the sheep moving down to get different water sources, or
you know, we haven't had those problems in the summer. They were basically last winter, and you know, either just before or during or right after the rut, and that tends to be when they move a little bit more. So, I would say it's more of a related to the you know rut than it is to the drought.
Because I know a lot of our country, the springs are all just drying up. Is there?
Absolutely. Yeah. Hopefully we'll get the rain and help that out with that. So.
A little smaller couple.
Yeah, a couple of
months. Snow? What's that?
This time of year.
I'll tell you what, right? I started springs, buddy.
Any other questions from the rack?
Yeah, one more question for me. Did I understand you, Katie, did you say these fees, like for bobcats, $5? That's for 6 bobcats?
5 each. So last year was 3 per person.
Oh, okay.
So $5 each times 3.
Gotcha.
Any other questions by the rack? Any questions from the public? Okay. Any comments by the rack?
I have one on bidding off those muskrat special trapping areas. I think it was for waterfowl management areas. Seems to me like young boys trying to learn how to trap are most of the muskrat trappers, and it seems to me like that might be taking some opportunity away from some boys who want to do some trapping.
I think talking to them a little bit, again, Bill's probably maybe Boyd, but I think talking to them, there's plenty of recreational trapping opportunities around the state. It could, sure, but right now, even under the draw system, it's just never a guarantee. We just don't, it's a random process every year. You know, we get 40 or so applications for the 12 permits, so it's already really restricted and limited. But it just doesn't help us meet the needs that are out there.
We don't have the problems out here with muskrats digging and compromising any of the water impoundments that we have that we can't get control of. So I don't know that it's that we would contract it out. We would probably leave that open for kids to be able to go trap.
I just say that my hope would be that some person would bid on it and hopefully take their son or daughter out and teach them how to trap. I think it'd be a great opportunity, and that would be the idea. But it's probably not something you can just turn over to, you know, somebody without experience to do on their own. We need adult supervision.
Okay. Any other comments by the rack? We have one comment card here, Kent Bowden, Utah Trappers.
Mr. Chair, members of the RAC Board, I appreciate the opportunity to talk. First off, on the marshes, with the muskrat that was proposed, the managers of those have had their hands tied. It takes specialized equipment to be effective on those marshes, and they don't just trap the rats, they're after the raccoons and fawns. There's a myriad of things, and the inexperience in trying to train the youth, it's encouraged, but it's detrimental to the marsh, and that's why we're glad to see that it's been talked for quite a few years, and the marsh managers have needed it, so we appreciate that. Utah Trappers is opposed to the increase, due to the fact that it's 200% increase. It's taken 30 years since its inception. It's been at $5. The division has not looked at that fee, to my knowledge, in all those years. And we feel that it's a knee-jerk reaction to what happened in last October. We would prefer, if you do raise it, we would prefer incrementally looking at it. That's all I have. We are opposed. Thank you.
You are opposed. Okay. Thank you, Ken. Okay. Discussion by the rack. Any further discussion? Motion.
Wait, yes. Could we go back to some discussion, maybe?
Okay.
To me, it just seems like $5 for a bobcat permit seems really, really low, especially when you look at the value, I guess the market value of that pelt it's a 420 canyon, is that what you said?
The average is 407.
407, whatever. How does that compare to other states? I mean, I'm not really track. What does that compare to? I mean, how does that compare to our neighboring states? $5 for a bobcat.
Is it a question?
Do you want
to? Yeah. It's kind of a comment and a question, I guess. Really, I mean, I don't know if that's discussion amongst the rack here.
You have somebody that has an idea, a handle on it?
We've done an analysis while he's walking up there. We looked at a bunch of the surrounding states. They're all over the board. Yeah, I mean, some really jack up the price of the fur bearer license, and then they included in that. Some presented, some are cheaper, some are more. It was kind of everywhere.
Okay. Yeah, Ken.
To answer Mr. Omega's question, that is an average for 1 year. The market could drop.
Sure.
And they would be essentially, we've seen them down to $50, $60. Mm. So it's a very volatile market. It's all supply and demand. And there's a lot that goes into that $407 average. There's pelt handling, the way that the trapper handles the animal. There's so many variables in that it's just phenomenal. They could drop tomorrow and be worthless.
Really?
The $407 as a return on bobcat is a misnomer too, because the cost to harvest over 30 years average is 1.3 cats per trapper. The cost to harvest that with equipment, time, and fuel and everything is probably closer to $600. They don't do it for the $407 average. They do it for the love of the pursuit and passing the heritage on. It's more of a family function than anything, and it's passing down heritage. And a lot of people use it to spend time with their kids. And you get into it, it's really unique and wonderful in that aspect.
Okay. Thank you.
How about the other state questions? Do you know what the other states?
As far as the price?
Yeah.
The fur market is a commodity, and it's extremely volatile. Coyotes can go 1 year; they can go from $70 to nothing.
I mean, as far as the cost, the $5 fee is Wyoming.
As he said,
it's just
every state
fur bearer, and they include
it. Nevada doesn't have a fee for their tax; temporary tax.
Oh,
Mr. Chairman, can I ask him a question?
Sure.
What would you, if you think six permits are too many, what would you like to see?
It's not the number. The six tags is based on going back to the management plan. As you'll see in the later slide, there's certain triggers that can make that number of tags fluctuate.
So you're okay with the six?
We support that wholeheartedly. Yeah.
So we'll get more information under number 8 on the fur bearers and bobcat harvest. So this is, I guess, for a review, this is a proposed fee schedule.
Okay. Yeah, they just overlapped enough that I mentioned it here, so you wouldn't have to hit it again for 40 minutes on the next one.
Okay.
I've got a question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
How many years has it been since you've had a fee increase? How many years has it been?
1985.
1980.
I think it was 1980 it was established. Has there been any other programs
that's probably not that long, but there's been some that have been allowed to persist for a while before we look at it.
Is there a reason it wasn't reviewed earlier to do this in an incremental rather than a giant leap?
You know, I don't know. It would have made sense. Maybe Bill knows more.
We actually talked about it last year a little bit.
It's a long hop, skip, and a jump from the 80s.
It is, but you know, it's just one of those things that there's just been more pressing needs, and so you know, and the cost of the program gradually increased. One of the things that we do now is, well, we've done for quite some time though, is section two, each two, three section costs about $4. We do the harvest survey. It's a cost for conservation and officers and biologists to check in all the bobcats. You know, what Kenny said here tonight is very conservative. We we're probably paying a lot more, but some of the things that we do, that's just part of our regular duties, so we wouldn't add that to that. So I think that's probably mostly just the cost codes that directly hit the Fur Bear program. And, you know, sometimes we're just not paying attention. We're just going about other business and don't think about it.
Mr. Chairman. And also in other instances, the costs of the program have been absorbed into other programs. And this just was time for us to take a look at it, to parse it out and say, well, we do our rabbit counts, and instead of charging that to the big game program, Bobcat needs to, you know, each program ought to be able to stand on its own.
I got one more question. What did the other two racks do that you had meetings earlier this week?
If memory serves, we kind of landed at some sort of compromise based on last night. I think it was they wanted us to do a little more research on the costs to actually implement to cover the program and cover the cost of issuing permits and then doing the seal of the hides. Come in closer to that, not to exceed $15. So 15 was kind of the high end, 10 was kind of the low end, if I'm remembering that right. And it was similar down in Southern. I'd have to get my notes, I missed that one. I think it was really, really close to that down there too.
And they made a motion to have the permit fee reflect the cost of the program.
Not to exceed the 15.
Any further discussion from the board? We have a motion, a discussion of a motion.
Actually, I like that idea. I was kind of thinking the $10 fee was something we ought to propose, but I kind of like the idea of finding out what the program costs and doing what I'd like the Southern region did.
With the not to exceed 15.
With the not to exceed 15, yeah.
Chairman, I make just one comment.
Yes.
For Dan's question over there, Dan asked about neighboring states and what they did. Remember, there are neighboring states, Colorado. You can't trap a bobcat in Colorado. So it is kind of a privilege to be able to catch or trap a bobcat and do what we do here in the state.
So it all costs.
And to do that for this expense
is it's a privilege. Well, and I guess, yeah, just a comment from my point. Watching different families and fur bearers and some of the trapping, it's diminished over the years. Diminished.
Come
to the mic, state your name if you will.
My name is Randall Rubio. I believe in Colorado it is $66 for non-residents slot cap permit, and it's unlimited. And so even though you can't trap with the use of hounds, you can still exceed six bobcats in a year or a season plus. I think $15 is excessive. I'd be more willing to pay maybe $8 for the state of Utah, but $15 would be way too excessive.
Did you get the name?
No.
Is the mic turned on?
Fernando Rubio. Correct? Fernando.
Yeah.
I like your idea.
Thank you.
Quick comment. There's a couple of ways to look at this as well, guys, and I hate to be, you know, playing on either side of the fence, but you can be angry that there's an increase, because I understand that it's been the exact same way for so long, or you can be jacked at the fact that we made it from the 80s to now without any changes or fluctuations. And I realize that that's kind of playing the long game and you're looking at instant gratification, but we made it this far without any fee increases, and we all know that the cost of everything is gone up exponentially in the increment. So there's a couple of ways to look at that.
Yeah. Yeah, including fuel.
Including fuel, yeah.
Okay, call for a motion.
Well, is that what you're thinking? 10, 15?
Separately to accept the other fee increases or change that along with the bond
counts. And 10 would be a jump, you know.
So would the motion have to go?
So what Boyd was explaining to me was if we go with what has been presented, the other option would be what recommendations could we make to the Wildlife Board?
Why couldn't we compromise and say, okay, let's go with a 10 instead of a 15 right at the top, you know? I know it's a little more than what he says, but, you know, it takes time and money and to run a trap line.
Okay.
Make the motion to go with the fee schedule as presented. Except for the bobcat to go with the $10 fee.
I'll second it.
Randy seconded. Did you get the motion?
Yeah. Motion to go with the fee schedule as presented, except for the bobcat to
go with the $10. All in favor? Yes. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Everybody else was unanimous, but one opposed.
Okay, thank you. Leslie McFarland, update us on the Cougar Management Plan.
I like this stand, you can't see me.
Everybody's interested in this one.
Yeah.
And first I have to thank Bill for doing my first two RAC meetings for me while I was off doing my other job until that job is filled. So I'm playing musical jobs and catch up here for a bit. That being said, I've been in this position for about 3 weeks. So be gentle with me and understand. I know. Well, and just some history, I started 24 years ago, and I worked with Boyd when Boyd was the mammals program coordinator. So I've got a little history, but this will be my first time in this seat. So Just a little bit of history on what we're talking about right now, the Cougar Management Plan. In 2009, the current Cougar Management Plan was approved. In 2011, some minor amendments were implemented to the plan. And in 2013, it became obvious that everybody's not happy with the plan the way that it's written. It's very confusing. It's very... it's hard to implement, and it's hard even for the people within our agency to implement, okay? So the Wildlife Board directed our agency to simplify the plan and allocate permits on a unit-by-unit basis. Being that I've only been in this position for about 3 weeks, I did not have much time to work with anybody to simplify the plan. And quite honestly, everybody needs to be able to buy into it in order for it to be a good plan. On July 8th, I was able to meet with the Utah Houndsmen Association, the Utah United Wildlife Cooperative, and representatives from Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and let them know that I can only make some minor adjustments to the current plan, and that I would like to have the next year to put the Cougar Advisory Group back together to work on a plan that everybody can be happy with, that's simple, and that meets all of our needs. So what the changes that I made to the plan basically will still take 3 years of data and analyze it on a large scale, because that's important that we take into account cougar biology when we look at how, I'll show you a map in just a second that explains what I'm talking about. Permits and quotas are now allocated on a unit by unit basis. It doesn't go to a large area and then the whole area dictates what happens in a management unit. Now permits are for that unit, and that's the only harvest that will take place in that unit. The one safety feature that we have now, the previous plan locked us into 3 years of recommendations. We are going back to a unit or to a yearly analysis of the harvest, and then looking at what the harvest was and adjusting the permits every year. Okay, so it's not... the previous plan said we'll recommend permits for 3 years, and that's what it will be for 3 years, and we don't make any changes till after those 3 years. So that now is gone, and we're back to adjusting and reviewing permits annually. For that reason, and because permits are assigned to a unit, it makes female subquotas very difficult to implement when you've got smaller permit numbers for smaller areas. So we did away with female subquotas, and we looked also as we were doing this, a request that came out of this meeting was that we look to include all female cougars. Right now, when we analyze our data, we do it on adult females only. They want all females to be considered. So that will be in the future plan. So in the future plan, like I said, I'd like to reopen the plan with input from the Cougar Advisory Group to further simplify and make adjustments over the next year. 3 weeks just really wasn't enough time to do what really needs a lot of consideration. One of the things that the Houndsman Group asked for specifically is in the future that we look at female harvest less than 40% on each unit. So when we talk about analyzing data, we have cougar management areas, which are the large colored units. So that's when we talk about an area, we look at all of the data for that area, and that's how we determine permits for an area. Then what we do is split those permits and assign them to a cougar hunting unit. So the cougar hunting units are what everybody is familiar with. It's your Buttcliff's Bitter Creek. It's your, what's another one?
South Slope.
So it's the smaller unit that you're more familiar with. And that's how we manage hunters to harvest cougars, but to assign permits, we look at a larger area. And then we have predator management units, which are not pictured on here specifically, but it's where we're trying to minimize cougar populations for the potential benefits to big game populations. So those are the three types of management that we do. Okay, so in our current plan, and I left the performance targets and everything alone, so everything is the same as it has always been in previous years. The primary target, we want to manage for the proportion of adult females in the harvest to remain between 17 to 20%. We don't want it higher than that. If it goes higher than that, then we decrease permits, and if it goes lower than that, then we can increase permits. And so that's how we adjust it. We also took and looked at the previous year's harvest, looking at 40% females to see if it would have made a difference in the permits that we recommended this year. And then we have a secondary target. So if your primary target's being met, you look at your cougars trade per day. And as long as it's between, 0.3 is ideal. If it's between 0.25 and 0.35, then you can adjust permits. So if it falls below that, then you'd want to maybe decrease permits. And if it goes above that, then you could increase permits. But that's after your primary target. So your number of females in the harvest is considered. And so predator management units specifically, they're determined by our predator management policy. Regions can choose in these areas to either have a split or harvest objective strategy. And permits or quotas are assigned to each of those units. In these units, the unit closes when all the permits or the quota are filled or when the season dates end. We have three units in our state that are unlimited take units that are managed primarily because they are bighorn sheep areas with low to no deer numbers. So the primary prey for cougars in these areas is bighorn sheep. And they're the Buck Cliffs Rattlesnake, the Caparowitz, and the San Rafael. So I just have, I don't know if this thing will work, and I'll try not to blind anyone. Does this work? Okay. So this is just looking at historical cougar harvest, and it's, was it up there? I'm on the ceiling. Okay. So the yellow line is total harvest of both sexes, okay, over our history. You can see here in the 90s that we did harvest a lot of lions, okay? And that has slowly, the trend has slowly decreased, and we're about 300, we harvested 330 lions this last year. But that's not complete because we still have some seasons that are open, so those numbers are not final. The red line here are your males. And the brown line are your females. So when these two lines are together, your female and your male take is 50%. So you're taking as many females in your population in harvest as you are males. So where you want it to be is actually you want your male harvest to be up here, and this is really a good sign that your female take is diverging from your males. So they're not 50%. So then this is just total percent females in our harvest, and we're sitting right about 33% overall in the entire state. So that includes harvest objective females, everything. That's all sport females. So our cougar season dates, I won't go through, but they're pretty much standard for what we've had for each of our previous seasons. So I won't go through each of those unless you want me to. And then, like I said, we also took and looked at percent females in the harvest. And in all of our cougar management areas, the percent females, the harvest in it is falling below 40%. This is a three-year average. So you can look at the Monroe. It did hit 40% in 2011. But the average over all 3 years is 36%. And this is all females. This isn't just adult females. It's all females. On the Uintas unit, it hit 42% in 2012, but the average over 3 years is 38%. There is a request in the southern region to take the Pine Valley unit, which is this purple unit right here, and split it into two units to have a Pine Valley North, which would be a split, managed as a split unit, and then have the Pine Valley South managed as a harvest objective. And so this is what it will look like. That'll be the North, and that'll be the South. And the reason for this, they're looking at transplanting some bighorn sheep into the south part, and so they want to increase the harvest there a little bit before they release sheep. Overall, total of permits, so I looked at limited entry and split permits. We were fairly consistent in 2012 and 2013 with 347 permits. This year, for limited entry and split, we're down to 253 permits that we're requesting. Part of this has to do with some units transitioning into harvest objective. Some of it has to do with some units that we've lowered permits on. Specific unit recommendations, I won't go through and read each one. I'll just highlight the changes. For limited entry permits, these numbers are exactly the same as they were last year. No changes there. On our split units, we have the Central Mountains Nebo. That unit is decreasing from 16 permits down to 8. We have the Central Mountains Nebo West Face. That unit is decreasing from 25 permits down to 8. We have the Mount Dutton unit that actually was increased by 2 permits from last year to account for a recent mountain goat introduction, just to kind of keep some pressure and help the mountain goats take off for this year. And then the Pine Valley North, that's going into a split from the whole Pine Valley unit, and that will be the recommendation there is 7. The Plateau Boulder is decreasing by 1 permit, and that permit was given to the Mount Dutton unit. The Plateau Thousand Lakes, that is decreasing by 1 permit, and that was given to the Mount Dutton unit. And then everything else is the same as it was last year. On harvest objective, the Fillmore Oak Creek is transitioning from a split unit to a harvest objective unit with the same number of permits. The Pine Valley South is the split of that Pine Valley unit, and it will have 10. Wasatch Mountains of Viniquin will have an increase of 2. Last year it was 13. Wasatch Mountains Cascade is seeing a decrease by 7 permits. Wasatch Mountains Timpanogos is also seeing a decrease by 7 permits. And then, like I said earlier, we have the 3 unlimited take units, and they are the Bookcliffs Rattlesnake, the Caparowitz, and then the San Rafael. And that's what I have for you there.
Thank you, Leslie. Questions by the rack?
I have one.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to figure out your treed. 0.25 to 0.35. So is that a line treed one every 4 days or one every?
So we actually do a pursuit survey, and we send surveys out. And so it's an average reported, and it depends on each unit. But let me see if I've got it here. So what we do is we take... we surveyed 288 out of 738 permits. 81% of those people reported that they treed. 83% of those were who pursued. And mean satisfaction was 3. And so by unit or cougar management area, then they report a number. So, for example, the total tree lions reported on the Buck Cliffs unit was 348. Now, that doesn't mean that's 340, let me clarify that. But, yeah, it's not 348 individual lions. Some of those are probably retreat several times.
Questions for the RAC?
I noticed that our area had the highest female harvest of any of the others. I'm just a little bit concerned. I'm quite anxious to hear what the houndmen, how they feel about that, of lifting the female sub quota.
So, which area specifically? The Buck Cliffs? Or, okay. So, the which one?
UNSS.
Okay. So let me explain why. When we were applying permits across large areas, it's really easy to apply a female subquota, especially when you're doing it over years. When you're taking and you're splitting, I mean, we're trying to manage hunters, you're taking and splitting these into smaller units. And so when you do that and you try and put a female subquota, a lot of times you're doing it on a lot less lower permits. And what'll happen is that you can actually under harvest, or if your females are harvested like right early, then you don't get the harvest that you actually need for the entire unit. So the safety valve actually is that we review harvest on an annual basis. And any time that female harvest hits like 17 to 20% that we currently have, or if it ends up being whatever the future management plan ends up being, if it's 40% all females, then you would decrease the permits the next year. So it doesn't happen immediately, but we are reviewing it every single year.
Can I make a comment to that?
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking there might be a few more females released if there's a subquota, because they're fair that, you know, the season will close. And I'm thinking it's a good thing. It's a protection.
And I guess when I look at it, I mean, I'm trying to take it kind of back where we've been in the past, where we didn't have female subquotas, but we had harvest on units. And I mean, that's the safety valve, is that we will review that every single year. And if the harvest of females increases more than what it should be, then the next year you adjust those permits and you say, okay, we need to decrease by whatever metrics we end up setting up in the plan as a group together.
Let's see, why don't you tell them what happened with the cash last year? I think that's a
okay, so let me, actually that's a good point. So we had several units last year that closed down way early. The cash in particular had a female subquota. It shut down on February 28th. The quota was met actually by limited entry harvest. So the way that things were calculated previously, you had the limited entry counted toward the harvest objective, but it wasn't it's a mess. But it closed. So the limited entry opportunity closed it down, and it never transitioned. And that was, there was a total of 15 that could be taken, and the total that was taken was 7. 5 males and 2 females. And so there's concern that if we have the female subquota, it causes a little bit too much conservativeness and allows kind of unrestricted growth. Because we're not getting the harvest that, I mean, when we put the permits out, we're saying that that's what we want harvested in these areas. And so if we're closing it down before we meet what we expect to be harvested, it kind of affects our ability to control it.
Yeah, the two females didn't even hit the 40%. And so, you know, when you have a female subquota on a small unit like that, it just makes it really difficult to be able to get the harvest you need. And the cash is one of those units where the deer hunters up there are really concerned, and we need more cougar harvest than seven lions.
Well, and what it did too is the cash actually included some of our urban area. It included the East Canyon Davis Face, which is a really, really difficult unit to get people to harvest in. And we didn't get any harvest out of that because the whole thing shut down. And so that's our concern, is that there are areas and needs of places that we do need the harvest in, and we're worried that with the female subquota, we can't get that.
Good question. What exactly shut it down? Is it because of the percent quota, the females to the males?
So the female subquota on that unit was two, and the minute that two females were harvested, the whole thing shuts down. And so that's the purpose of the female subquota, is when you hit how many females you say you're going to hit, all harvest stops regardless of anything else.
Well, if the first two were females and killed, that'd be 100%.
Exactly, and then the whole thing would shut down. And so that's the concern with it.
Any other questions, whether
I? Yes, I do, Leslie. This seems a little bit unfair to you to have this for just a short time and then have to go through this. But I know the board, Wildlife Board asked this a year ago. Has there been some work going on before it was handed to you on this?
Shelby didn't address that.
I'll do it. So the person that was in the previous position failed us. And didn't do probably exactly what was directed for us to do. There was one meeting, and it was held May 18th, and it didn't include everybody that should have been there. And so the decisions that were made in that meeting, I couldn't take or accept because it didn't include all of the players that should have been involved.
Okay.
And if if it falls on anybody's shoulders, it's mine, because I was the supervisor. And I tried to get it done, but it just didn't happen.
I appreciate that. I mean, I can understand that, but I think it's fair to the houndsman and everybody to understand what happened.
And so we're trying this year. What we're proposing is just a Band-Aid to take care of it for this year, and then reopen the plant and make it better next year.
And when I met with them all on July 8th, that's what I was trying to stress. Just let me get through the recommendations, because it was 3 weeks. Let's get through this, but let's work on the next year to improve the plan and have something that everybody can live with that's simpler.
Any other questions by the rack?
Do you manage tag allocation by area, and then you manage hunters by certain units, correct?
Yeah, so what we do is we look at the data. So let me go back. So, for instance, the Oker Stansberry, all of those little outlines, the little gray lines, are each hunting unit. So when we look at the Oker Stansberry, we look at the cougar population as a whole for that entire area, and we do it over 3 years. And then we take the permits that would fit for that area and allocate it to each of those little units.
But you were managing the female subquota as of last year by unit basis.
No, the female subquota was applied to
the entire region.
So when I was talking about the cash, it's everything in blue. So that female subquota, that's why it shut down every single one of those units, because the female subquota in the cash was met. So harvest in the other areas of that unit did not take place.
Any other questions by the rack? Any questions by the public?
Daniel Davis. My question is a little clarification on that subunit deal. Had that been managed unit by unit, would it have shut down that whole unit with the female subquota?
If so, it would have...
If it would have applied to a single unit, would it have shut down that whole portion of the map?
No.
Another question is in the Cougar Management Plan, part of the objectives was to reduce units under predator management. And the guidelines to be considered predator management is if the amount of wildlife is at 65% or less of the target densities, right?
No, it's, so when you look at deer, it's 90%, less than 90% of objective.
80%
survival. So if it's below that, it triggers. So over a three-year period, if it's less than 85%, it goes into predator management. If it drops less than 80% in 1 year, it goes into predator management. Or if it's, and so that's less than the 90. Does that make sense?
Name's J.C. Brewer. I understand how you count ungulates. How do you count cougars?
Good question. We rely on looking at the harvest metrics, and we rely on looking at the tree per day. And so that's what we're using right now to estimate how the population's responding. But I think the last population estimate was in the 90s. Is that correct, Bill?
Yeah, I actually could respond to that, too. We actually use data from research studies that we've had a 10-year study down on the Boulder Mountains. We've had over a 15-year study on the Monroe Mountain. And we've also looked at the densities. There was another study that was done up in the Raft Rivers. And in those studies, they've been able to come up with a density. And what we did with that estimate back in 1999, when we did the first Cougar Plan, was looked at densities of similar habitat, either Utah or from other surrounding states. And we came up with kind of a minimum number of cougars in the area, you know, in that specific unit. And so it's not like, it's not as exact as it is with deer, but, you know, it's in the ballpark. So.
Thank you. Any other questions from the public? One more question, please. Okay. Is anybody else? Go ahead.
Daniel Davis. Could you tell me who wasn't present at the first meeting?
The May 18th meeting, the only people present were Dan Cockane from the Houndsman Association, Brett Selman from the Livestock, Dave Stoner from the Utah State University, and then the Mammals Program Coordinator at the time, John Shivick. And so, one board, Wildlife Board member, Mike King.
And so there was one organization that wasn't present, but they did submit a letter?
No, Kirk Robinson was not present. There were also a couple other houndsmen that were not present. Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife was not present, and United Wildlife Cooperative was not present.
But there was more present to the first one than the second one?
The second one, yes, there were more present. The first one, there were five people.
Okay.
I've got just one more question.
Come up to the mic. State your name and ask the question. Sorry, we just for public record.
How can you get an accurate count of Rubio of the lions, number of lions, especially when you can tree the same line multiple times in a year?
Right, we don't have an accurate count, it's an estimate. And it's an estimate based on those metrics. And we realize that when they report, like I said earlier, what was it? 348 lions treed on the Buck Cliffs. And it was a total number of 1,500 days. And there were 0.23 treed per day, and 4.8 were treed per pursuer. I mean, that's how we get to, if it's between 0.25 and 0.35, and it's about 0.30, then that tells us that the population's that it's probably stable. And this is based on other research studies that also looked at density and what percent you should be treeing based on your population density. So it's an estimate, but it's not exact.
Any comments by the RAC? Comments by the RAC? As we go to comments by the public, I've got the Houndsman. I have four pieces of paper. You have one representative that could get up and represent the Houndsman. Okay. And then we got one individual, Weston, would be the individual. Are you part of the Houndsman?
Yeah.
Okay.
Daniel Davis, I'm representing Utah Houndsman Association. Like Leslie stated, in August 2013, the Wildlife Board asked the DWR to open the Cougar Management Plan to simplify it and return to harvest limits based on management units rather than management areas. Near the end of May 2014, some of the Cougar Advisory Group met in Salt Lake City to review the proposed management plan changes. At the time, the proposal did not include a female subquota. It was decided by the group to include a female subquota as a safety stop to prevent the overharvest of females. David Stoner was asked, with reviewing the most current research and setting the subquota based upon the research, he felt it would be somewhere between 40 and 50%. In July, that's a typo, should be 2014, after a change in personnel within the DWR, a small group of some of the Cougar Advisory Group members met in Springville and were presented with a totally different Cougar Management Plan. This plan did not include a female subquota, but it did contain much of the same language of the original plan, except it did set harvest limits based on management unit and change the review period from once every 3 years back to reviewing and adjusting permit numbers every year. At this meeting, the Mammals Coordinator agreed to changing the language in the plan to include all females that are harvested to be considered in the calculation to determine if tags would be adjusted up or down. The plan you have been presented does not include this change. After one full year, we have a cougar management plan that is still confusing, a plan that could potentially eliminate cougars from many areas of the state by an extreme overharvest of female cougars, a plan that does not seem to reflect the scientific principles that it says it's based on. We feel that it's a failure on the part of the DWR and should not be expected accepted. With the understanding of the change in personnel, it's kind of hard to reach that. We are asking you to do the following. Number one, we ask you to vote to reject the plan as presented. Number two, we ask you to accept DWR proposal to set the permits based on management units. We ask you to vote to add female subquota of 40% to the plan. Vote to consider all females harvested in the calculation to adjust permits annually. And we also ask you to vote to require GPS location of all cougars harvested. A little clarification on some of this is the location harvested. It can be harvested in one unit and reported in another easily to maintain an open unit status when it comes close to a quota. We hit some issues last year. The RAC was on our side last year. We didn't want some things to happen, and they did, and it was pretty detrimental. A lot of these considerations take that into effect, and we ask for your support on this. The 40% female subquota, the reason we feel that way is because that's our safety net. There's no safety net, as Rod stated earlier with his questions. With the plan that they have proposed on the percentages that they plan to manage these female numbers and animal numbers in these units, takes into consideration your female harvest without a safety net. We agree with the percentages and everything that they're asking for, because if you put it out there and you kill, if you kill, 20% females, or 17% females, it's a 10% reduction. So what they're doing is compensating for that female harvest without a safety net. So if what we've seen in the book cliffs is our biggest concern, it scares us bad. When you have harvested the toms that were harvested out there and the abundant of numbers that were harvested, when the female numbers start going up, that's all that's left. Well, the female numbers at the end of the season before they close the quota skyrocket. We're concerned that if it was to happen again this year without some type of a safety net, we'd start off at females, ending at females. And we feel that we would put a huge detriment to that unit based on the harvest of the females without a safety net. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any questions?
You're not allowed to answer.
Oh, you can't do that.
It's common.
Oh, is it? Thank you. Well, they've asked questions in the past, like last year, it was huge.
Okay, and we've got passed just your letter and stuff, and we'll pass this on. Okay. Discussion by the board.
Mr. Chairman, may I address some of the things he just brought up? Would that be all right?
It'd be all right.
We worked with Utah Houndsman Association. They did make the request for us to look at 40% females and include all females in our analysis. And I think it was very clear from the presentation that we did that. We didn't, he made the comment in the letter that we did not, but we actually did. We had a table up there that showed that. And it made no difference in the recommendations. So I just wanted to like you to know that was in there, and thank you. There was another something else about WASP. I guess I'm getting too old.
Can I clarify my statement on that, though?
Sure.
My clarification on that statement was for a female sub quota at 40%. Not that there was no consideration of managing at that 40%. We're asking you to pass a female sub quota that would close that single unit, not a wide unit basis like it is now, but that single unit that 40% female harvest is a clarification.
Discussion by the board. I know as we lead into this thing, the Wildlife Board asked them to look at this and sort of revisiting it, and we're at a band-aid point, but yet we've got to have something to go forward for the year. Just an overview.
I guess I got a question for Leslie. Looking at the plan, I don't know what page it is, you'll adjust the permits on an annual basis, which will allow a division to be responsive to population fluctuations, such as large annual declines in big game herds and total female cougars in the harvest greater than 40%. Now, that tells me that they are considering total female harvest, right? Which is, I think, one of the things they had in there. So you are including that in your calculations. And you are including greater than 40% in your calculations, although it's just not stopping the unit. If I understand it, we're just not shutting the unit down because you don't know that until the end of the year.
So we're not being immediately responsive. We're letting it go through the entire year, and then we will respond and adjust permits for the following year, which is similar to what we do with big game and all of our other.
Okay.
Any discussion by the board?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I would like to know where you guys are, as the Uintas and the Bookcliffs are neighboring the tribe. We've only got probably five guys that hunt them. And Hill Creek is a big area. It's almost as big as Bookcliffs. And like he was saying, if there's a lot of females, a lot of the toms from our side are going to go over there. A cat will travel 200 miles.
Right, that's why we do the big units.
But to where he says that the GPS, I totally agree with that. Because one person could kill something and turn around and say, well, I killed it here, and it really wasn't even killed there.
Can I just comment on the GPS thing? So I've done the wildlife disease program here in our state for 12 years. Part of that requirement is that when a hunter brings me a deer or an elk, or our regional people a deer or an elk, they have to tell us the location of harvest. That has been very difficult to get from people. It's just kind of an almost unenforceable law. And if you put it in, you make the honest people more honest, and you make the dishonest people more dishonest, because all they have to do is make up a point. It doesn't mean a thing. I mean, we can require it, but it's not really going to change anything. If law enforcement, and Tori, answer me if I'm wrong, but if law enforcement is relying on these locations for their case, I mean, it's so easy to make up a point. I don't see that it's going to change anything.
Yeah, but don't a lot of the help?
I mean, right now when lions are checked in, bears, all of that are checked in. We ask for a drainage and we ask for a location. And I can tell you in the 24 years that I've done it, hunters are very protective of the places that they go because they're afraid that you're going to release their place that they hunt to everybody else. And so they don't like to tell you where they go. If there's an issue with a case, usually law enforcement can make the case. So.
Well, in theory, we would love to have GPS coordinates on everything. But then we get the excuse, well, I don't have a GPS, right? Yeah. Where do I get this? And then they point at some spot on the map. I would love that. It would be great if we could get it, but it just hasn't happened.
From a biological standpoint, I'm so sorry, I've got
no, you're fine.
From a biological standpoint, hypothetically speaking, and I realize that the probability of this is limited to none, but let's say 100% of the tags that are allocated had a harvest of a female on them, and it was reviewed annually, and it came back that 100% of those came back as female kills. What is the detriment on the population going to be of mountain lion?
It completely depends on the unit that it is. I mean, some of the units...
But the answer is we don't know what the population is.
Exactly. And so it's a guesstimate.
So we're pinning the tail on the donkey to some degree.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think we have fairly good ideas that it stays at some level, just based on historical harvest and that our trend is not fluctuating hugely. I mean, it's staying pretty level. And so that tells you that you're staying fairly, you know, the same overall with what you harvest. So it's not...
Does the state feel confident that if it were to happen, and I realize we're weighing probability and consequence, if it were to happen, that we would have a rebound of population, that it wouldn't be overall detrimental? Because that has to be taken into consideration.
It takes time. And I think that that's the concern, is it takes time to rebuild a population if you knock it down to a certain level. But back in the 90s, we did, I mean, that's part of that graph. We went in and we were really selective on some units and went in and really hammered some units to see what the response would be. And over time, it does bounce back, but it takes time.
Right. There's so many variables that come into play here. I want you guys all to know that when we take those into consideration, we have the same confusions that you do. We don't know what the population size is. We don't know how many are being harvested. We don't know if people are being honest in the harvest that they're taking. So be gentle on us, too, when we have to make these recommendations to the board, because we're trying to find our ass on the map, too, here.
Any other discussion from the board?
I have a question.
Oh, you can't. Excuse me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. We're at the point of, we've had public comment, we've had questions, and we're down to the point of discussion as a board to make a motion. So that's what this discussion's leading up to, is a motion.
Motion that we accept the cougar management plan and recommendation as proposed.
I'll second that proposal.
Proposed by whom? No, because we have two current proposals on the table.
Oh, proposed by DWR.
By DWR is what I propose. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I will second the motion.
Okay. We have a motion and a second on the table. We need to vote on it. All those in favor?
Four.
All opposed? Three to four.
It has to be three to four.
So
that motion failed.
Okay. The motion failed.
All right, so we debated. Now what?
You as a board need to decide what the motion should look like.
What's
the next proposal? What kind of recommendations can we make to the Wildlife Board?
We've got
to have a female subcourt.
there's eight.
Yeah, one abstained.
You had one
abstained.
One abstained.
Did I hear that? Are you kidding me?
Where's your spine?
So who was in favor? Tim?
I was in favor.
Tim and David.
And David. And Tim?
Yes.
Okay, so three, four.
3-4.
And Mitch abstained, and Rob Carey ran me down opposed.
Yes.
Okay.
Another motion on the table. Anybody want to propose something?
I'll make a motion. We go with the Cougar management recommendations as presented, other than I feel we need a 30% female subquota.
As presented by DWR. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why do you feel that that would be advantageous?
Why would you feel that would be advantageous?
I just feel like it's dangerous without it. I think that it was on that chart there. We had looked up, there was like 42% for a high and 38% in our area of the females taken. And we've got a lot of houndsmen here that are very passionate about their hunting. And when I talked to many of them, and they like to see most of these females released.
Okay.
They like to see the toms taken, the females. And if we don't have a subquota, there's no control.
Rob, why would you go with a 30% instead of a 40%? Just to keep more around?
The only reason I went from 40 to 30% is because what the division had to say about it. Is so I lowered it from the 40% to 30.
So I don't understand.
But that makes it more restrictive.
That, yeah.
If we went to 60%, then 60% of the animals harvested could be females. If we go to 30, then only one of three can be harvested as a female before it shuts the entire unit down.
You would cut the cougar harvest by...
It's still less females that could be taken, though, if you said that
30%. But if you have a unit that's only got seven tags on it, you take one female and you're done. For everybody.
It won't be that way with the new plan.
Well, no, what it'll do is change the permits for this year. And
so
it'll really restrict harvests.
Can I, before we go to, can I ask for clear?
I think you wanted to go the other way. Instead of 30, you wanted to go to 50 to 60.
So here's an example. So if you have like box elder,
yeah.
So here's an example. So here's the permits that are recommended for this year. Box elder desert, if you had, what number are you recommending? 30%?
30.
So what would that?
22.
Two of those five could be female, and once two of those five were harvested, then the entire unit shuts down.
But that also reflects the population.
Actually, it's only one.
Sorry. So on units with really small numbers, if the first person goes in on the opening weekend and harvests two females, the entire thing shuts down. So you've got, with a split unit in particular, you've got limited entry permit opportunities that are out there. So if somebody goes out first weekend and harvests two females, the other three people will never get a chance to hunt.
But those tag numbers are also based on the forecast of population within that unit. So if there's no population, of course, the numbers are small. So to sustain, you got to limit your numbers.
To sustain what? An imaginary number?
Some type of population.
Is there an active cougar study in Utah at all right now?
Yes, we've got several.
Where?
On the Monroe, and what's the other one? It's just the Monroe right now.
What does it take to get a cougar study in my ground here?
We can talk about that later. But
yeah, we need to focus on what we need to do here as a board, as a GRAC committee.
You've got to provide.
So you've got one. You got a motion. Do you have a second?
I'd like to amend the motion to do the same thing Rod said, but only use a 40% subquota, female subquota.
And then the motion with the 40% subquota?
I'll say again.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Okay, we understand the motion?
I'm not quite sure. So it's do everything with the DWR has proposed, except include a 40% subquota for females, correct?
Female subquota, yes.
That's what it is.
It seems like it reduces their hunting opportunity. But if that's what you want, that's what you want. Okay. You can pay the money.
That's about what the hunting opportunity we're recommending also.
It would this year, but it wouldn't be following years.
Okay. Yeah, that's what they want.
Okay. I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
I will vote.
4, 2, 5, 6, 7.
Seven, yeah.
That'd be 8, be unanimous. Is David?
No.
You're opposed?
I'm opposed.
David's opposed. Okay.
7-1.
They don't want people to hunt after they paid for
it. Did you get all on the scale?
That just amazes me.
Okay.
A lot of dollars.
Well, thank you. Okay, Leslie, let's take a look at the fur bearers and the wildcat harvest recommendations.
Make more. Why anybody would go in and hurt wife in the mouth?
Janet was blaming back on your front porch or something. Okay, so this one's a little easier. So we have a bobcat management plan that's been in place since 2007. This plan uses four variables to adjust permit numbers and season dates. So the variables are the percent young, and the target range that you want is 42 to 56%. The adult percent adult survival, you want it to be 65 to 72%. Percent females between 41 and 45%. And then your set days per bobcat, you want, so when we do our survey and stuff, you want it to be between 177 and 220. So based on the past 4 years, 2011, 12, and 13, all of those variables, most of those variables were falling below or above target range. However, this year, three of the four variables fell within target range, and the fourth variable, set days per bobcat, continues to improve with a decrease in the number of days. So when three of the four triggers are met, you can go back to baseline within the management plan. And so the plan actually says if less than two are outside of the range, I think I should say are within the range, it should return to baseline. And baseline is 6 tags per individual. Season going from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday in February with no cap on the number of tags sold. And so our recommendation is to increase our permit numbers to 6 permits per individual. The season date would be November 19th, 2014 to February 8th, 2015 with a no cap on the number of permits that are sold. And then I'll move on really quick to the other fur bearer seasons. There are no changes from previous years except for it should have started on the 28th and I moved it to the 27th because the 28th is a Sunday. And that's for those species you see listed. And that's what I have for you.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. Questions by the rack? Any questions for Lisa? Yep. Questions by the public? Any questions by the public? Any comments by the rack? No comments by the rack. Okay, we have two comment cards from the public. We've had John Clegg and Kim. So, John, do you want to come to the mic?
We'll have Kim Campbell speak first.
Okay, combine them. Okay.
I may comment later. But
I don't know if he's with Utah Trappers or not. So.
Yeah, I am.
Kent Todd, Utah Trappers. We wholeheartedly support the plan as presented by the division. However, we would ask for support in an extension of the season, and a two-week extension. The reason behind our request is we feel that it will be beneficial to the survivability of the juveniles and the females. If we can go longer into later into the season, into the spring, it gives us the opportunity to harvest more toms. The toms are more active. It just makes it easier to harvest them. Most trappers would prefer mature toms, and they would be willing, through selective harvest, to turn tip-belly cats, females, mature females, and kittens loose in search of the mature toms. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. John, do you want to make another comment?
Apparently, them goober, not John.
My name's Don Clagan. Our family has trapped for years out here. At one point, I had a large family of eight kids, and it was part of our supplemental income when we had all the kids at the house. And it has actually become kind of a heritage for our family, which we have now are passing on to our grandkids. I support the recommendations wholeheartedly. I believe that the longer season would be helpful because we are after the bigger toms because they do cause problems with the kittens, plain and simple. I know earlier when they talked about tags and the cost of the tags and so forth, I'd like to make a clarification. There was numbers poked out here of 407 on average, but I remember years when, you know, we were doing good to get a $50 average. Our last year expense per day ran 45 cents a mile. We were running 92 miles a day, every day, and we were 10 and 50 traps. That does not count tires. That does not count the front end that I burned out of my pickup. I mean, what I'm saying is yeah, $400 is a lot of money, and if you add that up between six cats, I probably got twice that invested. But I'm investing in my children, and I'm investing in my grandchildren, and that's the thing that we're trying to do as a family, is to build that heritage, and we want everything to work as good as we possibly can, because not only do we trap, a lot of people think the trappers are bloodthirsty, but we love the animals that we go after, and you become bonded with them. So I fully support with what Kent said, and I would recommend that we go the longer season if we could.
Okay. We as a RAC, any discussion?
I've got a question.
Okay.
What's the DWR's position on the longer season?
Well, I kind of looked at, I'm not opposed to the longer season at all. I did take a look at the data just to see if there was a trend in the proportion of juveniles taken or females based on the time of season, just in the data. If I can get this, it's not working right here. There really wasn't a huge change overall, except for about week 11. There appears to be a jump in 2013 in juveniles. As far as females, I have that here somewhere. I just can't get this thing to work great.
Try your arrow keys.
But the female chart was similar. There wasn't really a decrease or increase over the whole period. It kind of stayed steady.
One thing I would add, though, that going from three permits to six permits and from a cap of 4,600 to unlimited, I think we have some concern that if you also lengthen the season, that you're getting to the point you may have an impact on the population. So I would just urge caution.
Keep the doors open. It'd
be nice to look at it 1 year and see, you know, does it make a difference? You know, it's liberalizing things quite a bit. It would be good to get 1 year data under our belt to see if it makes any difference or not.
Well, from a procrastinator's point of view, if you give a procrastinator an extra 2 hours, they'll just procrastinate another 2 hours.
I have a question, Wade.
Okay.
How long are you proposing to extend the season?
Just two weeks.
Two additional.
The Southern Board give us a week. Anything would be appreciated. Again, we just feel that we recognize what the changes are. But again, we're after, it's no different than to some lengths as the houndsmen prefer mature toms than thimble trappers.
Any discussion by the board or a motion by the board?
Could I ask a question? Would it make a difference if 2 weeks were taken from the beginning and put on the end?
The problem, as I see it with that, is if the more trappers you get out earlier, affects the coyote harvest, because in the early season, the bobcat trappers are picking up coyotes. In the later season, the coyotes drop way off, and there's after cats specifically.
Sorry.
Well, that kind of confused me. She said to take 2 weeks off the beginning of the bobcat season. Isn't that the... When is coyotes and bobcats? I'm not quite sure.
Coyotes is year and a half season.
Okay. So if you take 2 weeks off at the... You know, so you delay your bobcat season by 2 weeks and then extend it 2 weeks longer. How does that impact coyotes?
We're asking for extension. We don't want a chance to start. There's other...
Why?
There's other people involved in this. There's the Hounds Association. There's callers. It was mentioned in an earlier act. People like to go on Thanksgiving and utilize that weekend. And so it's not just the trappers that I'm concerned about. There's other users, other harvesters that are involved in this too. That's why an extension would be better, leaving the start date the same. And for us, probably we're all involved.
Weather's
an extension would be better.
Weather's a big factor too, since it's in there.
Can I make one comment? The reason why on the 2 week and on the end, your toms are usually traveling a lot farther that time of the year because they're looking to mate. And so that's why your averages of your bigger toms is going to be more likely at the end of your season than you are in the beginning. Now, if you're shortened up and you still got tags to fill and you pop a kitten in, you're more likely to take that kitten knowing that you've got 2 days left versus an outer 2 weeks in order to fill a tag. And so that's the reason, and I've seen it. Some of me and Laura's biggest cats come towards the end of the season. They don't come at the first part of the season. And so that's what we're after, because that's where the better dollars and stuff are at. So.
Okay. What does the RAC have for a motion?
I'll make a motion that we do it as presented, that we approve it as presented with the extension of 1 week, with the idea we come back again next year and see what that's done to us. And if that's done, if we've caught too many cats and we can back it off, if not, we can maybe add that second week.
Second by Mitch. Okay. I have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Three.
Oops.
Seven. All but one. 7-1. Motion passes.
You say all opposed? I don't see her saying.
There we go. I have abstained.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you.
Okay. We have taken care of all of our action items, reviewed everything. Is there any other business?
Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
I second.
Second. All in favor?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you guys.